listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I am broadcasting from the sunny Chicago suburbs. I'm really happy that you have joined me today at republicbroadcasting.org. I highly recommend that you also visit and subscribe to spingolaspeaks.net and screeningsandyhook.net. For those who celebrate Easter, happy Easter. I invite you to visit our very friendly chat room at spingola.chatango.com. I do not access my regular email address during the program. So, if you have questions or comments, just mail them to comment@spingola.email. If you inadvertently add an S at the end of comment, it will still arrive in my email box. If you wish to review the names of the guests that I have had the pleasure of interviewing on this program, just visit spingola.com and click on the radio schedule button on the left side of the page. I also have the names of future guests. In both instances, I have links for those guests along with relevant links for their subject matter. I thank my good friend Clint Richardson for subbing for me last week. I was taking a 4-day class on energy medicine, specifically Eden energy medicine. My guest today, speaking of medicine, my guest today is Dr. Shola Shadi Isokoli. I might be butchering that last name, for which I apologize in advance. Her website is Shola Isokoli. That's E-Z-O-K-O-L-I. And Shola Shadi. And that Shadi is shade.com. She is an innovative CEO and founder of Balance with Dr. Shola, LLC. She is a triple licensed physician, an ICF certified professional coach and strategist. She is a corporate and conference speaker. And a best-selling author. And again, a triple licensed internal medicine physician. She started her career as a medical doctor, but her passion for helping people led her into public speaking, writing, and professional coaching. She helps people avoid burnout and helps them to live a stress-free life. Dr. Shola, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Do we have our guest?
Hello? I said thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, I'm just delighted to have you on the program. Your blog is wonderful, and I think we will have a lot to talk about today. And initially, there was a concern, and there is a concern in the medical field about physicians and physician suicide and what contributes to it. And so hopefully we can start out there And I know it's really, well, tell us what you're going to tell us about physician suicide and why it occurs.
So physician suicide is contributed to by a number of factors, myriad of factors, which stem from, it could be organizational, it could be personal, and it could also be, I would say, societal. So, for a bit of statistics, it's said that we lose 400 physicians a year to suicide, which is very tragic. That's pretty much one doctor a day, one point something doctors a day in the U.S. Professionally, we have the highest rate of suicide completion of any profession in the U.S.
Wow.
The question is why? And that leads us down the road to talk what they talk about, what we call burnout. Of course, as with anyone else, the causes of suicide are myriad. For example, there was a time when the stock market crashed all those many years ago, people killed themselves because they were losing money. People with depression and other mental disorders have high rates of suicide. And again, these people are also found within the medical profession. My focus has been on avoiding and preventing what is known as burnout among physicians, which can lead to poor mental and emotional health and even poor physical health in physicians also. And that's where we are. That's where I am today, where I address specifically the area of physician burnout, both from the physician side and the organizational side.
Indeed. A lot of the thing, well, from my perspective, and I know my perspective probably isn't as relevant as your perspective, I think that people who go into the medical field do so because they want to help other people. And I think that they often don't realize that sometimes they cannot act with autonomy, that there are certain standards in practice that they must abide by. And a lot of doctors take on a huge amount of debt in order to become a doctor. They have a certain standard to live by. They have to pay that debt back while also attempting to establish a practice and then abide by the standard of care, which can be very daunting, correct?
So that is correct. When you talk about the standards of care, however, we are the carriers of the banners of the standards of care. And like you said, about autonomy. Now, when it comes to autonomy and patient care, physicians should, in an ideal world, should have as much autonomy as they need to be able to take best care of this patient. But what happens when I prescribe a medication and the insurance company says that's not covered, meaning that the insurance company has stepped in the role of a physician, telling me that this medicine that I've discussed with my patient that I think is the best practice, I cannot prescribe it because they won't pay for it. And as we know in the U.S., a lot of medications cost a lot of money, and sometimes people can't even afford the medications on their own, and they're dependent on the insurance company to pay for them. I remember a situation many years ago. There had this patient on a particular type of insulin. All of a sudden, the insurance company decided that they were not going to cover this insulin anymore. Now, this is a patient who, working together, this insulin had controlled her blood sugar for many years. All of a sudden, the insurance company decides that, hey, we're not going to pay for that anymore. We're going to pay for this other insulin, which, you know, we tried, but it just didn't work for this particular patient. Well, so what were we to do? So there is a very big loss of autonomy as healthcare is being taken over by people whose interest is more in the bottom line than in the patient. Now, look at doctors. We're bred, as it were, to take care of the patient. Your work is to help people and cure all the curables, and if it's not curable, you give the best treatment possible in order to get the least complications or symptoms possible from this disease. But when a physician is squeezed on every side, this does lead to, yes, a loss of autonomy. And coming back to loss of autonomy, that is one of the a significant marker of burnout, feelings of loss of autonomy. So that was a very good one to address, as it is happening, and it's from the news and the buzz that's going around, this loss of autonomy is only going to get worse.
Oh, absolutely, because so many of the practices, so many of the things that doctors have routinely taken as part of their practice are being taken over by drug stores and other facilities, and even clerks who really know nothing about medicine, have not been trained. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And it's a problem. So to see physicians who've given, as it were, given their life, and I'm not trying to paint physicians as victims, not at all. But it does speak to a big problem when the people who have studied this for years, all of a sudden they can't practice it to the best of their knowledge with their patients.
Right. And I don't know of another profession that is anywhere near that degree of loss, because people who want to help others and go into the practice of medicine do so because they have a certain amount of compassion and empathy for their fellow human beings. And then to have it be railroaded or actually monitored by the AMA, the hospitals, big pharma, and insurance companies is pretty awful.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We trust. So there are a lot of grassroots movements going on. People are starting to speak out. People are starting to call out organizations that are supposed to speak up in the interest of physicians, which ultimately is the interest of patients. People are trying to. People are going to the government. People are calling their government officials and representatives to make sure that this is something that we take seriously. So my angle is, in the meantime, dear doctor, what do you do about your own self? You know, doctors have something that I call a Superman complex or a Superwoman complex, where we feel that we have to take care of everything and leave our own health, our own wellness, and our own mental state, you know, behind. And it's only when we are ourselves mentally and emotionally and, you know, empowered, that we can actually step up and make the changes and be the best that we can be for our patients.
Right. Even when you're in residency, you are on such a lengthy schedule, like 20 hours on and 8 hours off. Isn't that correct, that residency, after you go to school, you go through residency?
Yes, and you go through residency, yep.
And it's almost like torture.
Well, it's kind of like, I used to describe it as the worst case, the longest phasing of your life.
Right.
Yes, and in residency, I think they have this method that is somewhat disempowering. For example, you're made to feel as a medical student that, oh, there are many of you trying to get in, but you finally got in, you should be grateful, and you should work hard to see Now you're a resident. Oh, you know there are not many residency spots. You finally got in. You should be grateful. Just, you know, put your nose to the grindstone. Don't complain. Just do everything you're asked to do. What is it? I mean, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. Being a doctor is hard. When I was your age, we used to work 100 hours a week. You should be grateful that now you only have to work 36 hours at a stretch. So these are the messages that are given to residents.
Wow.
By the time they come out, I would say it's a somewhat disempowered state to be in when you're told that, yes, okay, well, on one hand, you're told that you're the lead of the medical team. But on the other hand, don't question anything. Just do what you're told. So it's a very interesting dynamic. It's a very interesting dynamic. And, of course, put the patients first. And when you're dealing with people's lives, sometimes you end up leaving your own life.
Right. And, of course, you mentioned, too, that you're supposed to do what you're told, but then when you look at the people who are telling you that, you wonder what is their motivation? Are they being are lobbyists or people influencing them to select certain modalities that are really profitable for a certain group of people? And I know that the things that you learn in medical school sometimes counter what you're being told in residency. So isn't it kind of a conflict of interest in some respects when you're told that you're there to in medical school to help people? And then you're told in residency, just do what you're told.
Exactly. It's a weird dichotomy, right? And at least at that level, I don't think that's the place where I would say special interest come in. It's honestly more of the fact that in some ways, our seniors had it worse, but in some ways, they had it better. So, for example, back in the day, we hear doctors talk about, I didn't sleep for 3 days and I was on call, but you guys only have to work 30 hours. Yes, on paper, yes, we're only allowed to work 30 hours, but in what's happening in real life? I actually remember a time when I went without sleep for 48 hours.
Wow.
I don't know.
Oh my
how
gosh.
I know, I'm just thinking about it and I'm like, oh, wow, that actually happened. So
that's
even
2 days.
On paper, yes.
two whole days.
On paper,
I can't imagine.
Yes. And I can't even imagine.
So unhealthy.
Uh-huh. And believe me, you don't want a person, take it from me, you do not want a person who has not slept in 30 hours touching you. You really don't. But yet, this is what people are being, doctors are being conditioned to feel that this is normal. It's not, because at 30 hours, you're like a person with, you're basically like a drunk driver. So, you know, why would you want a drunk driver, you know, making your medical decision? You know? And
right.
it speaks to the fact that it's almost, and then when people complain, they're told they're not resilient.
Whoa.
Or that they should go and meditate, or they should go do yoga. You know, change the working conditions so that doctors are better, doctors are better off, patients are better off, you have less medical errors, less physician burnout, less, I would say, you know, it's scary, you know, to be the one in the hospital and you're not even sure whether the doctor is healthy enough to take care of you.
Right. The other thing, too, in residency, when you haven't had sufficient sleep and rest, aren't you more easily indoctrinated to things that maybe just aren't true?
That is
Oops.
A theory, yes. But
we do have a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back and we'll pick this up on the other side. Be right back.
starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, we are back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Dr. Shola Shadi Izakoli. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yes, Izakoli. E-Z-E-O-K-O-L-I. Izakoli.
Izakoli, okay. Thank you. As we were talking about these residents who spend so much time on the job, and my gosh, they could make a wrong decision that could impact their lives for the rest of their lives, a patient for the rest of their life. Why do they demand such hours? I just don't understand.
So, I don't think there's an easy answer to that one, but number one, there are not a lot of residency spots. Okay? So what does that mean? Because when you say there's not a lot of residency spots, like, well, can't the hospital open up more? Ha! Not that simple. So more people continue to graduate from medical school. However, during residency, which you cannot work, Americans, one country where without a residency, you cannot practice. You have to go into a residency, but not everyone gets into residency spots. And there's a limited number available because of the government. The government is who is responsible for deciding these spots because they are funded by the government. So, you know, given the stipend, yes. So a hospital can't just jump up and decide, you know what? We have more patients, you know, we need more doctors. Hey, I'm just going to open up these. That's not how it works. So there's a physician shortage, which seems to be as a result of some kind of artificial demand. Because, you know, a lot of people want to be doctors, and a lot of people do graduate medical school. So what happens to them? They get, so you have these small number of people in residency to do all this work. So this problem of not being a lot of residents present to do the amount of work that is needed. And as I was saying, a lot of older physicians do feel that we have it better now because back then they worked even crazier hours. But the fact that you worked crazier hours doesn't mean that. So, for example, you know, they say that when you say something is safer or better, it doesn't mean it's the best or that it's safe. It just means that it's on its way to improvement, and it could be made better. Definitely, the residency program can probably stand to have some more physicians, probably a rearrangement of the schedule, maybe a more shift-like work method as opposed to just the long hours. Now there is the argument, however, that doctors simply just need all this time to learn what it takes to care for a person. And so honestly, to a certain extent, that's true. Because you need to see as many patients as possible in that short space of time in order to be able to, I would say, be a good doctor. However, there are countries where residents don't work as crazy hours and they have longer programs. So in terms of years, they have longer programs, but they live a sort of, I would say, quote unquote, normal life. So you would have a maybe like 9-to-5 type of schedule unless you're on call. And you're on call once every certain amount of weeks. I remember when I worked in England, we were on call once a week. as opposed to when I came to America, we were on call once every 4 days. So there, I believe that there are ways that, you know, doctors are bright people, you know, and a lot of people who work in hospital systems, they're bright people. If we all found a way to sit down with all the concerned bodies and say, okay, this system needs an overhaul, where do we start? I think that's the answer to the problem going forward. The whole system needs an overhaul. Let's all come to the table with our solutions and see what works.
Now you mentioned, and thank you for that explosion, but you mentioned that the government is really the entity that decides on these hours and this this restricted number of people. In what way and why should they decide? It seems like they're deliberately attempting to limit the number of people who become doctors, and if that's the case, why?
That is a question for which I do not have any answer. It's I'm guessing it's because, of course, when you, the more residents you bring in, the more money you have. And this is me just sort of theorizing right here, because I don't have an answer to that question. But
okay,
you know,
let's think about that over this break, and then we'll have 20 minutes to talk it out. Okay, we'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Dr. Shola Shadi Ezekoli. And we're talking about some very important things. Gosh. The question was, in what way does the government decide the number of residents who are allowed to function in a hospital? And when you combine that with the fact that the government is Big Pharma's biggest customer, it would seem that there's kind of a contradiction here of some sort. I'm trying to figure this out.
When you say contradiction,
it would seem that they would want, if the government is Big Pharma's biggest customer, wouldn't they want more doctors who could responsibly dispense medication that might be of benefit rather than limit the number of residents? Because the number of residents ultimately determines the number of doctors. And if they limit the residents, it just doesn't seem to make sense. I have to figure this out.
No, it doesn't make any sense. Medical schools have increased enrollment by nearly 30% since 2000, but the commensurate increases in residency training haven't happened. And it takes a long time to train a doctor, right? It's not like a 6-month program, it's almost 10 years. So the sooner more spots are opened up, the better it will be for all of us. Because the more doctors they are, the more doctors they can distribute, the more doctors they can, I would say, deploy to various things. And the more we'll all be able to sit down and say, okay, we have X amount of doctors to be able to do X. How can we make this work for everybody?
Right. Yes, it is very disturbing. And now getting back to the suicide issue, doctors, therefore, because there is a decreasing number of doctors, a lot of doctors that I know have left their practice because of because they have to pay such high rates of insurance. They have so many things that would make them question, gosh, what am I doing? I'm overworked. I have the government breathing down my neck. I have the insurance companies telling me what to do. Some clerk in an insurance office is telling me what to do or not to do, is making medical decisions, when they may or may not have even graduated from high school. Why am I doing this? And so they abandon their practice and they retire. And then some of them retire by committing suicide because they must feel hopeless.
That is it. To see the life that you, I would say that you longed for, or let me say longed for, it's not, doctors generally, the kind of people who are attracted to medicine tend to be people who are, like you said before, compassionate, want to help. They usually have a story of maybe a really nice doctor, someone who treated them when they were so sick, someone who brought maybe a parent or a loved one back from the brink of death. So they're idealistic. Doctors tend to be idealistic people. And you take people with these ideals and sort of grind them into powder, as it were, with increasing demands on both the patient care side and the administrative care side. Then the doctors also have their own personal lives, debts to pay, high malpractice insurances, something called, we call it defensive medicine. You may have heard that term before, where a doctor, doctors are almost, in some cases, scared to trust their own clinical acumen. Because, for example, let me give an example of something that actually happened. I was in an ER one day, and someone came in with a migraine. So we were talking. I was talking with the doctor who was treating her, and you know, young lady, migraine. Of course, somebody in their 20s is not likely to have something like a stroke or something more serious. And this is someone with a history of migraine. So, yeah, straightforward. In a non-defensive medicine world, you would give the person some medicine to calm down the pain, some migraine medicine, and say, okay, bye, follow up with your doctor. But in these days of defensive medicine, what happens is, if you don't do a CAT scan, you're thinking, oh, let me do a CAT scan in case it's something. You know from your medical training that this is a migraine. They've had migraines their whole life. We'll just treat you and you go home. But because people tend to be a little bit, especially in the United States, lawsuit happy, you're thinking, doctors are thinking, if this happens in the small, tiny, very unlikely 0.01% chance that this is maybe something more serious like a bleed or a stroke, I want to have, quote unquote, covered myself. And what does that lead to? That leads to longer, you know, so for someone like that patient, she has to wait longer to get this CAT scan. It leads to waste of, you know, healthcare resources that could be better directed elsewhere. So this is the presence of something called defensive medicine, which is prevalent in our society. You know, as a doctor, you're constantly playing cover your butt, if I must use that term.
Yes.
So you have to do that day in, day out, and with all the other pressures, and unfortunately make people become disillusioned and hopeless.
And you have to make these decisions. You don't have a day or two to think about it. You have to make these right then and there, and you have to weigh these things immediately and make an immediate decision, which drives up healthcare costs. And then, of course, you also have federal laws like the Affordable Health Care Act, which seems to promise health care, but it really doesn't deliver. It really only affects, or primarily affects, the income of insurance companies, because now people are forced to buy something that they may not need or want, that they may never use, but it is income for the insurance companies. So
I think everyone at some point will access the health system in some way. And I can only speak to my, I would say, experience with the new insurance plans that came out in the Affordable Health Act. I believe that the idea is not a bad one. The idea is good, but the implementation of it was not the best. Because what ended up happening in my own personal, and now I'm sharing my personal experience and my personal stories of my personal patients, was that people claimed to take these new insurances, and once you sent patients to them, they got to the door and they found out, oh no, no, we don't take that insurance. You called the insurance company and they said, oh, we take Bubbler Bubbler Insurance. So you call Bubbler Bubbler Insurance Company, right? And they say, oh, this doctor takes Bubbler Bubbler Insurance. Send your patient to that doctor. When the patient got to the doctor, and like I say, I'm using my own personal experience. When the patient got to the doctor said, oh, no, we don't take Bubbler Bubbler Insurance. That's wrong. I had to do this with one patient 6 times for 2 different sets of specialists.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. So you have a product that it's like you have a product that you can't use almost. Yes, I remember, and I'm thinking of this poor woman as I'm sitting here, I close my eyes and I think of how much man hours stress on, first of all, the poor patients stress, the nurses, because we have to call these insurance companies, we have to send special referrals to them, so because their rules are now more cumbersome, and you have to write up referrals each time to these different specialists. So one doesn't take this insurance. Like, okay, maybe they'll take this other insurance. You call this other, they'll go to this other specialist. You call Bubbler Bubbler Insurance and say, oh, but we sent the patient to that specialist and they said no. So, okay, try this one. Are you sure they take that insurance? Yes, they do. 2 sets of specialists, 6 different referrals. So it just seems to me that the people who need it most had a product that they couldn't use. Again, like I said, I'm using this example of one patient in my own experience. And there were a few others, but this was, to me, the most trying for both me and the patient. Because in both of those instances, she needed operations. So, you know, we're trying to get you these surgeries so you can have a better quality of life. And now this product that you have, it's like you can't use it. And the most vulnerable people in the society are the people who are affected. For example, personally, I get my health insurance through my spouse's working. So I'm not affected by it, right? But unfortunately, it just seems like the people who needed it the most were unfortunately now in a state where it was just very frustrating. In the end, because, again, being a doctor, you don't give up. You don't want to give up on your patient. She needs surgery. So you keep pushing and fighting and fighting. But think of how many mad hours. Think of how much stress. Think of the fact that imagine one doctor doing this for multiple patients over and over again. And it could definitely cause doctors and patients to throw up their hands in despair and say, what on earth is going on here? Something has to be done.
And one of the selling points of the Affordable Health Care Act was that the people that you're speaking of, the people who need it the most are least likely to be able to use it, and they appealed. I think it was an emotional appeal to get it passed, and it isn't effective for the people who you say are most vulnerable. Plus, it takes, you now need more people in your office.
Yeah.
To do this paperwork and to digitize things and all the rest. Where it used to be, back in the olden days, you had a receptionist and you had a nurse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. You could
and
still have a referral on a prescription.
Right.
I had one assistant dedicated only to referrals. Imagine.
What?
Only
wow.
to referrals. And what was happening, too, was that other insurance companies whose demands never used to be so stringent, now all of a sudden, they're jumping on the stringent demand bandwagon because maybe because they find that, oh, okay, we can get away with this, too. So now they're jumping on it. Medicare reimbursements are reducing. Medicaid reimbursements are very low. So it's a perfect storm for, you know, pretty bad things to happen, really, unless something, you know, unless it's really addressed in a common sense way, in a non-political common sense way.
And that's the key word, political. They've politicized, I'm saying that wrong, politicized the medical industry to the point that it no longer functions to help anybody. Doctors, patients, or the people who are the end customers.
Yep.
Who does it benefit? It benefits big business.
Yes. Pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies who have big money to spend on lobbyists. So,
right.
You know, I would say pass laws, and I know this is a political conversation, but you know, when something has, like you said, become so politicized, you have to sit back and observe that, oh my goodness, if only it was just everyone just sat down at the table and addressed it in a common sense manner that's helpful for everybody concerned and not just the pockets of a few.
And the other thing too is that if the government, and this is basically what this is about, if the government has taken over the entire medical industry and people have signed up as for, you know, the Affordable Health Care Act, the government can then tell you demand and to have certain medical procedures because they essentially own your bodies. Right or wrong?
This is certainly a disturbing thought. You know, and like I said, nobody, no one, I don't think that the solution to this problem are going to come in one day or one week or one month or even one year, especially since there's a lot of vested interest in healthcare that are interested in, it just want to keep things the way they are. Yeah, so it's going to take a lot.
Yes. What are your views on, okay, let's take vaccines. I believe that that people should, when they are, they should decide whether or not they want to be vaccinated. Now, measles and chickenpox are not going to kill you.
Very good. That's a very good one.
They could if your immune system is incredibly compromised. But to have a government entity demand, such as they're doing in California and in some, I think New York City and in some places, to have a government entity say, you will be vaccinated with the chickenpox or the measles vaccine, or we're going to seize your children and put them into foster care or whatever.
Well, so again, I'm going to, this is where we're going to differ, because measles does kill. So the good thing about this country is that because of the vaccine program, these things are not seen as much as before. But I've worked in a country where I saw measles kill lots of people. But,
okay.
You know. We'll come back to that.
Right. Okay. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. All righty. We are back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Dr. Shola Shadi Ezekoli. And we were talking just before the break about measles, and a lot of so-called childhood diseases ended when sanitation improved and people began to not use, for instance, if you lived in a tenement somewhere and you had one toilet for 50 people, you're going to have issues. And when sanitation, fresh air, fresh food, fresh water, was more available, then you had better immune systems that could withstand a case of the measles. Would you agree?
Actually, what reduced the incidence of those diseases was vaccination. Let me explain a bit. Because right now in America, we have measles outbreak, but there is still the improved sanitation, the improved access to food, good food, and good water, and good toilets. I personally have seen, having worked in different countries, not just America, I've seen measles kill children, and it's not pretty. And not only does it kill, it also disables. So yes, there are some people, you know, just like everything else, obviously it has varying degrees of severity. There are some people who won't die from it. There are some people who will die from it. And I know this again, so this is another kind of hot button topic, but just based of what we can see in places where
people
are vaccinated, people don't get the diseases and don't die from them. In the places where they're not, they get the diseases and die from them because these bugs are in the air. You know, they are in the air and, you know, they're there. So, you know, and of course, being a doctor, I've seen, you know, you come to America and you see that, wow, places where they're vaccinated, these things have more or less been eradicated. And I just find it interesting that a lot of people who are vaccinated themselves don't believe in vaccines. But having said that, if you haven't seen an image of something, it's very hard to imagine. You know, most people who talk about measles being a disease that doesn't kill haven't seen it kill anybody. They haven't actually seen it because the generations of people that died from the measles, the polio, a lot of them, again, they're dead, right? And they're very few, like, they said something on somebody who was the last person on the iron lung from the polio, blah, blah, blah. But people, if you haven't seen something, honestly, it's hard to imagine its severity. But I have seen babies die from the measles. I've seen people get the meningitis. They can be vaccinated. You can vaccinate from it. I've seen people die of chickenpox. So for me, those images are very, very telling, as it were. And to come to a place where I know that, you know, my kids don't have to die of those because, hey, there's a vaccine. And the world, I mean, of course, people are getting more educated and sort of not educated, but people are getting more and more vaccinated, even in places where in the past never used to be available. So, you know, that's my take on that. That's my take on it.
Okay. Now let's talk about the flu vaccine. The CDC admits that the flu vaccine has not been effective for the last 20 years, yet you have Walgreens and other drug companies, particularly Walgreens, who touts the fact that they have given, I don't know, 60 million flu vaccines.
Yep.
Well, that's a lot of money. And now we have a situation where medicine went from a profitless entity to one that had profit and stockholders. And those stockholders, really, really like to make money. And, under Nixon, this whole scenario changed under Nixon in 1973. And so many things occurred at that point in time. Now, I had measles as a child, and I wonder, too, if vaccines create a stronger version of whatever disease they are attempting to inoculate against. Anyway, we're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back. This is fascinating. I love talking about this stuff, especially with
me too.
So we will be right back. Our guest, and I'm honored to have our guest on today, is Dr. Shola Shadi Ezekoli, and her websites are SholaEzekoli.com, and the last name is spelled E-Z-O-K-O-L-I.
E-Z-E-O-K-O-L-I. E-Z-E-O-K-O-L-I.
Ezekoli. Okay.
Ezekoli.
And Shola Shadi. Shadi is spelled S-H-A-D-E. SholaShadi.com. And you must read her blog, which we are going to get to, because she has a lot to share with us. It's, it's amazing some of the things that you've written about that are of such great interest. Now, anyway, we're talking about the CDC and flu vaccines. And the other thing, too, is that the idea that a whole entity would go from being a profitless situation to having stockholders and profits. And then you also, when people did get the measles, and even if you were vaccinated, sometimes you were required to have a booster vaccination, and then another booster, and might that contribute to, well, kind of the immune system, the destruction, or have an impact on the immune system, particularly when you read about the ingredients in some of these vaccines. Some of those ingredients are a little bit scary, like formaldehyde and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, our blood has formaldehyde in it. So it's not, well, in order to make a vaccine deliverable, there are just certain things that have to go into it to make it what they call bioavailable. So they are inactive ingredients in and of themselves. The inoculum is a small amount, and it's just like, you know, medicines too. You know, you have the active ingredient, which is small, but you have a bunch of inactive ingredients, like you need your Tylenol and whatnot, that make the medicine that you're trying to deliver more deliverable to the system. But back to what you were saying about the flu shot. The flu shot, generally, I do remember in one year where they said it was 75% effective. And there is no vaccine that is 100% effective. Just like there's no medicine that's 100% effective. Nothing is 100% effective. However, they take it as the benefit of having the vaccine in. So for example, let's say we have 100 people who would have gotten the flu anyway. If it was so that means it's 70. If we give all those 100 people the flu shot, 75 of them will be protected. 25 of them won't be. So that's taking it from 100 people that would get the flu to 25 people that would get the flu. Okay? And, you know, that's where it comes into where you actually see people who did get the flu and they still got the flu. It is, however, had been noted that even when they did get the flu, it wasn't as severe. And the flu, especially last year, you know, people did die from it. And the best, while things, there are things that are ineffective, it's about doing the best you can and keep working on that until you get the most effective method. It's not a perfect system, I know, but it's better than than everything we've had so far. So it's still better than having somebody, you know, die, whatever it is, at a young age or whatever, if they catch the disease, as opposed to the risk from the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Or the risk of it not being effective.
Okay. The other thing is that you were talking about adjuvants in the
yes.
vaccines. I'm not sure what year it was, but they added peanut oil to some vaccines, which, of course, the body rejected this and viewed it as an invader, which our bodies have self-healing properties and can recognize when something foreign is coming into their body. And so now you have a whole new industry in the EpiPen creation, where all these children are now carrying EpiPens that used to be very, very reasonably priced, are now just way, way up there. And there are school children. I remember growing up, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were wonderful. Peanut butter and jam sandwich, oh gosh, they were great.
Yeah.
But now.
They're everywhere and you just eat them.
Right. And they're good. I haven't had one for a long time, but I remember how good they were. And now children can't take peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to school. And, they can't, I've even heard of people who, maybe it was on a TV program, I don't know, but some person had just had some peanuts and kissed somebody that was allergic, and the person who was allergic went into anaphylactic shock.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, some of these things that they're putting in the vaccines are causing some horrible repercussions.
So I'm not aware of the peanut oil. So full disclosure, that's something that I'm not aware of and not aware of. And I'm, you know, I'll very happily, of course, go and study up on it. There certainly appears to be very high level of allergies that, you know, it does make you wonder why, you know, it really does. Like, why are these children experiencing allergies? Things that are not, you know, it's like, you can't, like you said, my children, you can't take peanuts into the school building. If they're just pretty much banned. You can't take anything as peanuts, you know, into the school building. And then they have, special tables for people who are allergic to peanuts so they can sit away from, you know, just in case, you know. So yeah, it makes you wonder, and you know, I'm definitely happy to go and do my own, you know, personal research on, you know, the peanut oil and the vaccine, because it's disturbing on many levels, right? Because the last thing you want is people reacting to things. And the interesting thing about this EpiPen, which is you know, now EpiPens are so expensive, you know, which is another, you know. The minute the prices went up, somebody got an $18 million raise. Somebody wrote it into law that, and then somebody's daddy wrote it into law that the EpiPen should be in all schools, you know? So this is what we're dealing with. Like, people who have no interest in health running the show and health. And all the people who are interested in health, the doctors, the patients, the nurses, the, you know, the truthsayers, being disempowered from really being able to effect any change, because the big change is brought about by the big money at the top of the game. And that is very, very disheartening. I have friends whose children need EpiPens. And the beautiful, wonderful thing, I mean that very sarcastically, the insurance company doesn't want to cover this EpiPen anymore. Or they'll cover like a couple of dollars out of a $600 medicine. It's
Which
terrible.
Is horrible. Because
terrible.
people depend on the insurance companies. They're paying for insurance. And it was
insurance.
Merck that decided in September of 1964 to create the adjuvant 65. And they're the ones that did it. And there's a whole book about it, written by, I can't remember the name of the lady that wrote the book, but I'm sure it'll come to me momentarily.
You can be sure I'm going to go read up on it.
She really explained the whole situation, and it's pretty damning, because now you have all these children, and it's not just that they're going to be allergic for 3 months or 6 months.
Yep.
It's a lifetime situation.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because of one ingredient that Merck decided to put into vaccines. Pretty awful.
Well, yeah.
So, let me share something with you. In 1973, Nixon did a personal favor for his friend and campaign financier, Edgar Kaiser, then president and chairman of Kaiser Permanente. Nixon signed into law the Health Maintenance Organization Act of 1973, in which medical insurance agencies, hospitals, clinics, and even doctors could begin functioning as for-profit business entities instead of the service organizations they were intended to be. And which insurance company got the first taste of federal subsidies to implement this law? It was HMOA 73. Why? It was Kaiser Permanente. Permanente. And what are the odds? Right? It really goes back to profit. And I think when a person doesn't go into medicine thinking, oh, I wonder how much money I can make. Certainly.
No, not really. No.
They're thinking more about helping their other fellow beings. They're not doing it out of profit. They're doing it out of compassion. Concern for their fellow beings. But the big insurance companies and big government and big pharma see it as a different kind of a situation. They're looking at it as profit.
As profit, and it's disturbing. And what I find the most painful is that, you know, the weird thing, you can still make a profit doing the right thing. You still can. Because the truth is that, okay, let me give you an example of something that happened to a friend of mine recently. Because I hear all these stories from doctors. She had a patient in the hospital that the insurance company wanted her to discharge. And she's like, you know what? This person, one more day and they'll be, you know, fit and ready to go. But guess what happened? Somebody from the insurance company literally prevailed upon them to discharge this patient. Like, we're not going to pay, da, 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 da. Guess what happened? Patient went home and was back with a complication, shook within 2 days. So that's more waste, because this patient, if they had stayed for one more day, right, they wouldn't have spent as much money as hustling the patient out, now having to do all the work to readmit them for a complication, whereas just the staying of one more day, and they would have gone home and not had that complication. So a lot of these so-called decisions are, you know, when it boils down to they're not helping patients, and they're actually making healthcare more expensive than it needs to be.
Right.
This is what we're up against. This is what we're up against. This is what doctors are up against. And for some reason, you know, the weirdest thing, people hold up doctors. It's now that, you know, so for example, with programs like yours and, you know, other programs like this, people like doctors, like someone like me can actually have a voice and say something. But what has happened historically is that the doctors are held up as the bad boys of medicine.
Right. You're getting blamed for something that you didn't do.
Didn't have any control over. I remember once I wrote the prescription for a patient. Girl, I have stories. Sorry, I said girl.
It's okay, I'm a girl.
I wrote a prescription for a patient, which I felt she really needed. And they said, the insurance company said, what about this other option? I said, this would be too strong. This is the best for this particular patient. I mean, I know the patient. You know, frail little lady, you don't want people to take something that's too strong for them. And you're always thinking of, doctors always weighing these decisions. So in my mind, and I discussed with the patient, this is the best medicine for you to take. What happened? The insurance company denied. And do you know what they do? They sent a letter to the patient saying, your doctor did not provide enough. And I'm only quoting this verbatim because
gosh.
I was mad. When they showed me the letter, I nearly pulled my hair out.
they're blaming you.
Provide enough information as to why you needed this medicine. Thank goodness there was a paper trail. I showed them the prescription. I sat them down and I said, this was what transpired with this phone call. I showed them all the papers where I'd done something called a prior authorization. In my mind, those should be illegal because they now want you to prove, as though your medical knowledge is not enough, they want you to prove again, why does this patient need this medicine? So I did, and I did that. So I showed them physically the paperwork. But what happens is most doctors wouldn't do that because, you know, nobody wants to feel as if they're just giving excuses. But I actually had them come in and said, ma'am, sir, I'm sorry, but this is the truth of what happened. Your insurance company sent you this letter, but it's not the truth. I did everything they asked, and they still denied it, and then turned around and said, your doctor did not provide.
Wow.
See? Yeah. And this is not happening with just one patient. Not two, not three. It's happening across the country, across the board.
Right. Well, and you're the one that has to face the patient. And yet, you're receiving condemnation from people who should be supporting you.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they're putting all of the blame on you.
Yes. The doctor is the bad guy. The doctor didn't give me this medicine. The doctor told me I had this. You can even hear it in the parlance. Well, I went to the doctor and the doctor told me I had this. No, the doctor didn't tell you had this. You had it. We're just diagnosing. We don't give people. I actually told some of us. We don't give people diseases. We just find out what is there, you know, and try to help you. So that is part of what doctors and patients are up against. Because ultimately, the work of doctors is to help our patients. But we have, for some reason, people say doctors are in the pockets of pharmaceutical companies. And no doubt some are, okay? Some are, but most are not. I certainly wasn't because I'm like, if only were that easy. They say doctors, they blame doctors for what the pharmaceutical companies do, what the insurance companies do, and what the government does.
Right. Wow. Well, there is a book that I mentioned. It's called The Peanut Allergy Epidemic, What's Causing It and How to Stop It. And a lady by the name of Heather Frazier wrote this. It was published in 2015. And then there was a rewriting of it with Robert F. Kennedy contributing. So I think it's of value.
You can be sure I will be reading that book.
Yes, Peanut Allergy Epidemic is what it's called.
By Heather Frazier.
Oh gosh.
Hey.
What a predicament. No wonder. No wonder doctors get blamed for stuff that they didn't do. They only went into the practice of medicine because they're compassionate, idealistic,
and
they want to help their fellow men, women, children. And they get blamed for it if something goes wrong. They get stuck with the blame because they're the ones that faces the patient. And also, the patient places their trust in the doctor. They see them face to face. They're not going to place their trust in somebody they don't know, but it's somebody that they don't know who's making these dreadful decisions and putting the blame on the doctor. That really stinks.
It's very, very sad. It's very sad. And doctors try. You know, we push back, you know.
Of course you do. Absolutely.
Yeah, we push back. We're just trying to do our best for our people.
Absolutely. All righty. We'll be right back after a brief message from our sponsors.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, we are back. I love that song. I always hate to cut into that song because I think that each of us are very important and we can make a difference. One person can make a difference. And I think today that person that can make a difference is Dr. Shola Shaddy. And she's our guest today, and I'm delighted to have her on the program. And I will post her websites in the chat room. And anyway, we're talking about vaccines, talking about peanut allergies and whatnot. And when I was a child, which was a long time ago, you didn't go bankrupt because you had a disease. If you had catastrophic disease now, you'd have to mortgage your house. Whereas before, you'd go into the doctor and they would fix you up, and it was reasonable. And also, and I pointed this out in my book about Sandy Hook, that what did I point out? What did I point out? The incidence of this TV advertising. When, if you watched television all day, which I wouldn't recommend you doing, but if you did, most of the, I would say probably 75% to 80% of all the commercials have to do with pharmaceutical drugs. There's only two countries in the world that practice direct to consumer advertising, and those two countries are America and New Zealand. So that when people see this on TV and they're programming, remember programming, and especially 75% of the people learn visually. And so they show you these wonderful pictures of people riding through the country with their hair blowing, in a convertible. And, meanwhile, down at the bottom of the page, it says you could get sick and die. You could have, heart patients. You could
your toe falls off and your heart jumps out of your body.
Right. And meanwhile, they show you these beautiful pictures and nobody's reading this stuff at the bottom. And
it goes by so fast, right?
Right. And so really, people will then look at these commercials and run into their doctor and say, I want this, this, and this. And without even thinking, well, gosh, shouldn't you investigate this? Shouldn't you look down at the bottom and read what they're telling you? This is a public announcement. And since you have been warned publicly, you cannot sue the pharmaceutical company. Because you have been warned. This is a public notice.
That is correct, and it's unfortunate. And people like to chase. So I'm going to say a couple of things about that. You're right, yes. Nobody, no one in the world advertises meth. It's illegal in most places. When I came to the U.S., because I grew up in Nigeria, I was born in England, I grew up in Nigeria, and I came to the U.S., I was like, wow, they advertise medicine on TV? I would say that to people, and people look at me like, yeah. And I'm like, isn't it strange? You know, people are like, no. And I would ask them, I would say, you know, this is not done anywhere else in the world. I didn't even know about the New Zealand. And I say, you know, this isn't done anywhere else in the world, right? And to everyone, because, of course, I was talking to people from the U.S., Americans, it's normal. But again, like you said, people run into their doctors and ask for this medicine. I would tell my patients, who would ask, and they would say things, they would usually start with Dr. E, because they called me Dr. E. A lot of them can't pronounce my name, right? So they say, hey, Dr. E, have you heard of this medicine? And first I would keep quiet, because, you know, I know where this is going. I said, what about it? Well, I saw this on TV, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So I said to them, well, I don't get my medical knowledge from TV. So that sort of quiets them a little bit. So I am more interested in your health and your welfare than my pocket.
Wow.
That's just the way it is. I'm more interested. I want your welfare. So if you're going to fight me and be mad at me because I'm not prescribing you this new medicine, then be mad at me, but be healthy. Right? I would rather you were mad at me and healthy that are happy with me, and then something bad happens to you. So I would tell patients up front. I say when new medicines come out, unless we are out of options, I don't prescribe them for, unless they've been on the market for 3 or more years. And the only reason I would prescribe a new medicine is if we've tried everything else and we are out of options. Ma'am, sir, do you understand me? And then, you know, some of them are like, okay. And other, some of them, I would now have to bring out something. I say, look, this medicine as it is now, I won't prescribe it for my mother unless we're out of options. And then they're like, oh. So that caught people off guard, like, she ain't gonna give it to her mother. Not gonna give it to her mother. So, you know, maybe there's something here. And I think for me, one of the things I did was being very authentic with my patients and very open. So it made them trust me. So if I say, you know what, take this old medicine that's been around since the 1940s and has been proven to do this same thing as this new medicine that you are trying to chase after.
Wow. All righty. We're going to a 3-minute break. Be right back. And our guest today is Dr. Shola Shaddy. Dr. E is what her patients call her. Call her. And I really admire your mentality. And
thank you.
The trust that you must inspire in your patients to really talk with him. And I'll bet that you spend more than 7 minutes with each patient.
I had to laugh at that one. I had to fight for 3 years to spend 20 minutes to have 20-minute appointments. I had to fight because I was given 15. And in these 15 minutes, it's not 15 minutes with you and the patient, it's 15 minutes with the nurse getting them from the front, bringing them in, asking them a ton of sometimes unnecessary questions, which are requirements by the government and not necessarily questions that have to do with your clinical visits, weigh them, take a history, da-da-da, and then you come in. Of course, by the time you come in, your 15 minutes is almost over because it takes 15 minutes to just say hello to somebody.
Right.
So, and it takes more than 15 minutes to engender trust. And it takes more than 15 minutes to treat complex medical problems because you know that this patient is not going to, it's not like, oh, you know what, I forgot something. Doc, I'll come back tomorrow. No, because your schedule is booked tomorrow with 20 to 25 patients. They're not going to see you for 3 months. You have to deal with bad diabetes, bad hypertension, bad asthma, bad liver problems in 15 minutes. It's not possible. And some of my colleagues, like you said, some of my colleagues in other places are given 10 minutes. And when you don't stick to that time, you're told, you're not seeing enough patients, we're going to cut your salary, et cetera, and on it goes.
Wow.
So yeah, this again, I keep saying, these are some of the things that doctors are up against, that because we've been, I would say, socialized, remember what we said about residency, in a
right.
sort of do as you're told way, you have to be stoic, you have to put your brave face forward, you're Superman, don't let anybody know what goes on behind the scenes.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
John D. Ehrlichman, who was with Nixon in 1973, when they passed the HMO Act of 1973, mm-hmm. said, the less care they give them, meaning doctors, the more money they make. Mm-hmm. I don't think you went into this to make money, and I don't think a lot of doctors go into it to make money. But this
no.
was their mentality.
That's frightening.
It is. And you were mentioning, too, that new medicines. And that new medicines, well, they really just have not been tested. And you also have to recognize that who's behind some of the campaigns. And there was a campaign, and it's called DART, D-A-R-T. And this organization, which was financed by Eli Lilly, published 8 million brochures titled Depression, What You Need to Know. And they also published 200,000 posters that they made sure got around. And DART means a depression, awareness, recognition, and treatment. And this was in 1988. And they had a $750,000 budget. And in 1988, I believe, I'd have to look it up. I wrote about it. But they created, this is 87, they created a drug called Prozac. And by 1990, President George H.W. Bush, who was formerly a board member at Eli Lilly, signed a presidential proclamation confirming House Joint Resolution 174 that declared that 1990 was the first year of the decade of the brain. So he was working right along with Eli Lilly. And when Prozac came out, it came out in 1980s, along with a lot of other SSRIs, Prozac was actually tested on only 287 people. And then they produced it, and the public became the guinea pigs. And it's very unfortunate because a lot of people got hooked on it. A lot of people suffered horribly. A lot of suicides. And this was only tested on 200. Yes. Yes, because what they were doing was using these drugs off-label, which they would take one drug and say, oh, well, this would be good for you, when it wasn't written for the particular situation that the patient was there with the doctors to see. But, gosh, now you have people in just a short period of time. Excuse me. By April of 2014, you have almost 79,000 people in this country on psychiatric drugs. And you have to ask yourself, gosh, what happened? Because now it's something that's very common that if you have depression, if you're depressed about something, and who hasn't been depressed about something once in a while?
I know, right?
Used to be. It's actually 78 million. 694,222. And it used to be that when you were depressed about something that had happened in your life, you'd sit on the front porch with your neighbor and you'd chat, and pretty soon you felt better.
This is a big issue, even for me. We've lost the community contact that is so vital, so vital to our health. Back in the day, like you said, people sat and they talked and they, you know, they weren't necessarily medicated for it. And it's funny how I would have patients who would come and be on antidepressants, and I would tell them, and I would try. I would say, you know what, let's get you into a therapy. Because, and this is what my sense was, look, if you're going to come off this medicine, let's have you in a therapy so that we can, you know, teach you some sort of thought modification process as opposed to just throwing some pills at you, maybe make you feel better, but not dealing with the thing that made you depressed in the first place. Now, there are a small amount of people who who do have situations where, quote unquote, everything seems fine and they have no reason to be depressed. They call that melancholic depression, and those ones, some of those have had benefits from medication. However, I'm very leery about throwing Prozac at somebody for every little thing. I've had situations where I've had to sit down and talk with people, cry, rant, rave. And I feel certain, almost certain, that if I'd gone to a doctor with these problems, I might have been written up for a medicine. You know?
Right.
And I have certainly seen people who have been on medicines that haven't worked. Again, too, I've seen people who have been on the medicines that have worked, so put that out there. But I really, really believe that there's a loss, like you said, the community contact that we once had, that where people just rallied around you, and even as we become more connected, people are more lonely. People are more lonely now. You know, there's social media that's supposed to be connecting people, but it seems like those end up being somewhat artificial because everyone on social media is just putting their best foot forward. So it's
right.
Not really a connection, more of just, oh, look at me. I'm at my vacation and blah, blah, blah. Look at me. And hey, look, full disclosure, I do it too, right? I post my vacation pictures. And
of course.
You know?
Of course.
But
you're not going to post something that's negative about yourself
exactly.
Or your life.
Of course. However, the remembrance that I always have at the back of my mind that if I have a real problem, I need human beings in my life that I can see and touch and, you know, be, that can talk to me through these things. We talk about Prozac. If only there was similar investment in actual therapists, actual human beings who can talk people, I would say, who can do cognitive work with people to help them lift those thoughts, to help them find ways of coping that don't involve medicine. Mental health services, real mental health services, are being cut right, left, and center. In Chicago, for example, a few years ago, they cut so many mental health services. So people who were in, you know, they were in homes, they had group therapy and all that. All of a sudden, all these people, they spilled out of group therapy. There's nowhere for them to go. They come to a doctor who was like, oh, well, here's some Prozac, you know?
Right.
So it's like a two-faced thing where you claim to be more focused on mental health, but really you're not, because the services, the real services that people need, as in the qualified therapists, the psychiatrists to do therapy and not just give medicine. I mean, now reimbursement rates for mental health professionals for therapy is so low that a lot of them can't even afford to take insurance. So you go to someone, so I have a problem, right? I'm like, oh, I need a person to talk to. Well, I have insurance. I have HMO. It's Classic Blue. That's the HMO I have. I'm going to go and talk to blah, blah, blah. The first thing you go is, well, we don't take this insurance. We don't take that insurance. You have to pay cash or you have to have a PPO. And sometimes the person who's in that kind of situation can't afford any cash.
Right.
This is all they have. This is all they have, and the services just aren't there. It's like you're putting your money in the wrong place and the wrong space. Just because this thing you're doing is going to make money for a few people. Whereas if you invest in real therapy, real mental health therapy, and things that make meaning in the long term, you know, I don't know, maybe they haven't found a way to overly monetize that. So for that reason, it's just like, it's sad to me.
It is. And the other, and as you brought up a good point, is that therapy, insurance companies won't cover therapy for 60 minutes, yet they will cover a medication meeting, which may take 5 or 10 minutes. And
It's disturbing on many, many levels. It's disturbing.
It
I mean, someone like me, I'm grateful and fortunate to have this knowledge and have a very good support system. But some people don't have that. For some people, a therapist might be the only human in their life
right.
that they can talk to and they can sit and address things. This happened to me a few years ago. Somebody came into my office talking about being depressed. I said, well, I listened to her story. And as I listened, you know, she was really venting. She was talking. She was talking. As you may have guessed, this took more than 15 minutes.
Sure.
Somebody's talking. I have to listen. She's crying. She's venting. She's pouring out of her. And I say, how long have you felt this way? She says, 3 years. But I haven't found anyone to talk to.
Oh.
I was like, oh, my goodness. So I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I did something a little bit unorthodox. I said, you know, I said, ma'am, can I pray? She said, okay, yeah, sure. So I held her hand, she prayed. And yeah, like I said, a bit unorthodox. And I said, okay, what do you feel? And I went the conversation about antidepressants, right? What do you feel about this, da, 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 and all that? She said, you know what, doctor? If there's some other way, da, da, da. So we went back and forth. We didn't have insurance for a therapist, but of course our insurance would pay for medicine. So now I'm torn. I said, okay, you know what? Here's a prescription. Hold it, okay? Don't take it yet, but hold on to it. Do this little thing. Try this here. I gave her some little, the kind of things I would talk to my coaching clients about, right? I said, okay, try this. You know, this is, you know, let's think about this differently. Let's do this differently. Let's try to get you some better sleep. Let's, you know, talk about a few habits that you could change. I said, just hold the prescription, but come back and see me in 3 weeks. And if you're even a little bit better, we'll tear this up. She said, okay, I'll do that. Of course, she was in my office for like an hour. And I'm like,
wow.
You know, let's try, right? Let's try. So she comes back in 3 weeks. She's a new person. She said, doctor, I even tore the prescription up myself because I know I'm not going to need it.
Wonderful.
So I'm like, well, if that's one person that we could snatch away from the, you know, having to go down that road, then yay, good for us.
I'm just so, so appreciative of what you just shared. It is unfortunate that more doctors are not like you. And I'm very sincere in telling you this. What a remarkable person you are.
Thank you.
Oh. You're welcome. You are welcome. Let's talk about some of your coaching and some of the things that you do. Unless you want to talk further about medicine, but on your blog, you have talked about balancing and you're certainly, an example of somebody that balances their life. And you talk about, on your blog, you say the unstoppable trio for long-term success. And then you talk about goals. Do your rest. The power of a personal retreat. Handling haters. 8 simple keys that work for all. And these are just,
yeah.
And there's 2 parts to that. But these are life lessons, and I think they were just wonderful. So anyway, we will be right back in 3 minutes. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today, who is a certified professional coach, and she helps people medically as well as giving them information on just lives and how to be happier and finding balance in your life. And her name is Dr. Shola Shadi, Dr. E. And again, I will post her website. Oh, somebody already did in the chat room. And, sholashadi.com/coaching And somebody else posted something from Peter Bregan, which he is also somebody that attempts to talk with people rather than simply throw a bottle of medicine at them. So I think you two would get along very well together.
I'm sure we would.
Yes. So tell us about your blog, and tell us, how do you handle haters? And
yes, haters.
And there's a lot of people full of anger out there.
Mm-hmm. That is true. That is true. But I think the thing is up to us as people to decide that we can only influence so much, and we should keep our concern and energy on the things that we can actually change and do something about that, as opposed to just being outraged over every single thing that moves. So about my blog, I recently launched a new website. Actually, I haven't even launched it publicly yet, but shalaizokoli.com, and I'm, you know, blogging is part of, you know, what I do. I write these articles so that people can come read it and, you know, hopefully apply what they see to change their lives. And being a doctor, it's not just words and rhetoric for me. It's about actually helping people with information that can empower them, that they can use. I always say that if ever I'm given a public, I used to say that a long time ago, if ever I'm given a public platform to do anything, I will always give people information they can use to better themselves. So I'm not just saying stuff to say stuff or to, because I like the sound of my voice, which I actually do like the sound of my voice.
Good, I like it too.
Thank you. I like the sound of my voice, strange accent and all, but the fact is that I really just enjoy giving people information that makes them go, aha, okay, I can use that, and I can use it to help myself, but I'm not just talking. So one of the pieces I wrote on my blog talk about handling haters, because like you said, there are a lot of people who are angry, and there are a lot of times people like to scream the word hater at everything. So, you know, it's almost as though it's impossible for people to have a nuanced conversation these days. I mean, like this conversation we had about vaccines, we're on different sides, but we're having a conversation. So,
right.
You know, I think it's worth exploring how to
handle
it.
Absolutely. Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We'll come right back and we'll talk about haters versus lovers. Be right back.
Yes.
Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Dr. Shola Shadi Izakoli. And her websites are ShaulaIzakoli.com. And the spelling is E-Z-O-K-O-L-I, and Shola Shadi, S-H-A-D-E.com. And I want to just mention, before we talk about coaching and whatnot and haters and lovers, is that you mentioned that we had a conversation about vaccines where we came different views. And I think it's really, really important to talk about issues rather than characters, to stay issues rather than saying, oh, that person is a shill, or that person is suspicious, or that person is this or that. Because if you castigate a somebody's character because you disagree with them, you destroy a perfectly wonderful relationship in some cases. And you can never again have a conversation if you go after a person's character. If you stick completely to the issues, you can still love the other person, still have a friendly relationship with the other person.
Absolutely.
But stick with the issues, and it's okay to disagree. Gosh, some of my best friends don't always agree with me, and it's okay.
And it's
okay.
Yeah. We're not going to agree on everything. That's the most important thing, I think. We have to realize it. You know,
yes.
I mean, so I was jokingly saying the other day to somebody that, look, sometimes I don't even agree with myself all the time.
Right. You have occasion sometime when you change your mind.
Mind.
It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly. So here we are, you know, and if I may, just say a little bit about my blog and, It's SholaEzeOkoli. There's two E's in the name. And, the other blog is...
Oh, I see. Yes. I'm sorry.
Eze. Yeah. No problem. And the other blog is going to be disappearing in a couple of months once I get this one up and running. I don't know if you compare the two. I'm sure you'll see a big difference.
Yes. Okay.
In the other one, you know, this one is more, you know, more professional, more business-like, and I'm just looking forward to really, you know, putting all my good content out there, you know, in a more, I would say, format that's more pleasing to the eye. And so ShalaEzeOkoli.com is my little piece of the internet out there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that's wonderful that you're just making it. We all make changes in our lives, and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yep. We were going to talk about
haters. The opening of the... At the opening of the class, at the opening of the program, I mentioned that I had I was gone last week, and that a friend of mine had subbed for me because I was taking an Eden Energy Medicine class. And we talked about protecting ourselves from people with negative energy, and it just opened up a whole new vista for me, and I'm sure the other class members felt it also. But sometimes other people's negative energies can impact our energy.
Yep.
But there are ways to avoid this.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, please continue.
Yeah, so we started to talk about, in that same light, talk about haters and how a lot of times people are outraged over things that, you know, not everyone that, I always tell people, not everyone that disagrees with you is a hater.
Of course not.
For the purpose of this discussion, a hater is someone who, I would say, a negative or critical person. So not someone who, you know, doesn't agree with something you said or did or whatever. That's not a hater. So I always tell people, before you start screaming, haters, 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 I have haters, keep things in perspective. Not everyone disagrees with you is a hater. You know, there are some people that had haters. Or like Jesus, hey, I'll say he had haters. They killed him, you know? So that's the fact that, you know, keep things in perspective is number one. Because a lot of times what people call haters are just people who disagree with them. Or someone disagrees with your Facebook post that all of a sudden they're a hater. That is not the case. Another thing is that, you know, not everyone will like you, your product, or your message. In fact, 10% of people will not be into you, and it's just math. So some of that is just being emotionally a bit detached from something that just, well, you know, this is bound to happen. Not everyone will like you, and that is actually okay. So I started keeping things in perspective and focusing your energy and your support on people who actually do support you, do love you, do, I would say your lovers, as in the sense of being opposite to haters, right? I couldn't find another word to use. So I just said, you know, focus on your lovers, as it were, using
right.
that word, of course, in quotes. So
right.
I think a lot of people, a lot of people try to defend themselves. They try to justify their position. They try to, you know, hit back at negative, critical people, but it doesn't, it's not a good use of your energy. Okay? It's a better use
right.
of your energy to focus on your supporters, love them back, support them. A lot of times we chase after we want the approval of someone who will never approve of us. And well, there are tens of thousands of people who do approve when we should be, you know, doing our best for those people. You know? I think my number three point was to listen to what is being said and find out if it's the truth. I think that is a big thing where when people hear things that are not delivered in a manner that they like, they shut down instead of saying, oh, is it true or not? Okay, mm-hmm. So somebody, I gave this kind of very facetious example on my blog where I said, if one person says you're a cat, ignore it. If two people say you're a cat, well, maybe they could be wrong. But if 50 people say you're a cat, you know, just get down on all fours and start doing meow. Because,
right.
you know, what is being said. And then if someone you love and trust and has your best interest at heart says, you know, this thing you're doing or this thing you're engaging in, it's maybe it's not the best for you. You owe it to those people to listen. So listen to, you know, this is the numbers of, you know, people saying the same thing, or people who are really close to you saying, you know what, maybe you're very rough in the way you talk to people. Maybe you need to use a stronger deodorant, whatever it is, right? Whatever it is, instead of just labeling people as haters, listen to what's being said and who's saying it and the numbers of people saying it. I also talk about not listening to the wrong people. So one of my favorite lines is, don't accept constructive criticism from people who have never constructed anything.
That is so, that is great. And I also have heard constructive criticism, it just is an oxymoron to me. It's,
I know. What's constructive about it?
Right. You've just blasted me. And that's supposed to be constructive. Constructive for who?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you have an example. So
Yeah.
Show that example.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So this friend of mine came and said to me, "Oh, you know, somebody said she just started a blog, so she was really excited about this blog, etc." So she says to me, "Well, you know, somebody said to me that my blog is boring. It's not interesting. It's not entertaining. It's not fun." I said, "Okay, does this person have a blog?" She said, "No." I said, "What's the person's qualification to tell you that?" Because this person I was talking to writes about again, another doctor in the space, trying to just inform people, giving people real information about cancer and malignancies and how to advocate for yourself with your doctor. So it's a serious blog. It's not a lighthearted, happy, happy, ha-ha blog. So I said to her, I said, "What qualification does this person have a blog?" She said, "No." She said, "Well, the person said she's read hundreds of blogs." I said, "Well, you know, don't listen to that. Don't listen to that." The same thing once happened to me. Someone said, "Oh, your Facebook posts are patriarchal, that people say that." I'm like, "Who are these people?" You know, and she couldn't tell me who these people were. I quickly came to the conclusion that, well, maybe she's talking about herself. Nobody says that to me about my post. And I generally get positive responses. So, hey, no, I'm not going to listen to that. We have to be selective about what we listen to, or else we'll be pulled down by the Debbie Downers giving us constructive criticism, in quotes.
Right.
Yep.
it's
and,
very
you know,
interesting, too. And just...
Mm-hmm.
Haters, and
yeah.
anger, and we briefly discussed anger. When you have anger, it's kind of like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die.
Yeah.
The person that you hate or the person that has harmed you. It's very, it's not a very productive situation to be full of anger at so many things or anything actually. It drags you down into the depths of somewhere that you don't want to be.
You know, it's very important to learn how to manage anger, feelings of anger. And also, I think when we've done something for so long, it becomes part of us. So if every time something doesn't go your way, you just reach your mind has been trained subconsciously to reach for anger every single time. Something doesn't go your way, anger. Something doesn't go your way, anger. Instead of sitting down to say, okay, well, you know, maybe I'm not angry about this. Maybe I'm just disappointed. Maybe I feel invalidated. Maybe I'm confused about the situation. So it takes a bit of, I would say, I call it self-coaching, to be able to, number one, name the accurate emotion of what it is and deal with that and what's causing that. And just really train yourself not to get angry at everything. There is so much outrage in the society. People pick one thing and they run with it. And I'm like, you know, people are talking and I'm like, I'm sorry, but I can't get outraged over this. I just can't. I choose not to give my energy to this thing. And another thing people do is they get angry over things that I call the circle of concern. There's some things you can change. There's some things you can't. So if you can change something, direct your passion to that. You know, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to help doctors deal with burnout. I don't like this situation. It's, you know, it's riling me up. I'm going to write this book. I'm going to help try to coach doctors to help them to deal with burnout. That's something I can do something about. Maybe you don't have maybe some kind of governmental power. Well, this is happening in the government. Oh my goodness. I'm so angry. Then what?
Exactly.
Focus on your circle of influence and do something there as opposed to getting outraged about things that are just in your circle of concern that you can't do anything about. Because anger just produces more anger.
Exactly. And as you say, there are only certain things that we can apply to ourselves. And for those things that we cannot change, we should not obsess over them or direct our energy and attention to them. And there's so many things that we can make personal decisions about. Also regarding anger, there are some people who use anger to control and manipulate other people. They have found that by using anger, that people that they control people, which is a terrible thing to do.
Stirring people up, you know?
Yes.
Yep. And energy spread, right? So
yes.
especially from leaders to followers, so to speak. So if you're head of an organization and all that. So if you're an angry person, that thing will spread. It'll spread because it's an energy. Like you said yourself, it's an energy. So it spreads through and people, like you said, they use anger to rile other people up to do things. They spread their own anger to either the followers or, you know, in a way that is very unproductive for the society at large. Because, you know, anger is just not profitable an angry response is not the consistent response that makes change.
Right. And I think, too, that even on a personal level, even if you're not in charge of an organization, that if you're just dealing with your family and your friends and you use anger to control family or to control people that you're supposed to love and care about, that is the worst kind of anger, I think, because people... It changes relationships. It changes people's personalities. It diminishes people when somebody that they expect love from, that all they get is hate our anger, which I guess you could say it's the same thing, huh? Hate slash anger.
Hate slash anger. And it's sad that people feel that that is the way to do things, you know? Someone feels like, oh, you know, if I yell at my wife, they'll do this, or if I yell at my kids and show this anger. But it doesn't come from a place of authenticity or love. It's just, it's fear. It's fear.
Right.
And fear can only, quote unquote, fear can only, quote, motivate. I don't like using the word fear and motivate in the same sentence, but fear can only, quote, motivate people for so long until after a while they'll either rebel or they'll just run away from it.
Right. Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
I'm really enjoying this. I'm really enjoying this show. I'm really enjoying myself right now.
Me too.
So, you know, thank you for having me. I am having the time of my life, believe me.
Oh, I am too. I love having conversations with people of your character. And
I just
have a lot of commonality. You should live next door.
There you go.
Yes. And it's wonderful to have you on the program. And in number four, you also said, the person tried to talk me out of my dreams. Somebody that tries to do that, gosh, what might a person who believed this angry, hateful person, what if they actually took their advice, and what would they have missed?
I saw this same thing happen to other people before me. And it was unfortunate that I was not the one who was going to be talked out of the dreams that I've held in my heart almost my whole life.
We've
come a long way with just being able to look at someone and say, okay, you know, I know you're my friend and I'm in a relationship with you, but what you're saying, you're coming across to me as a hater and I'm not going to listen to you.
Right.
Yeah. You mean, even if you can't say it directly to the person, just embodying it and saying, no, you know, you're wrong. You're wrong in this instance. And not being angry with the person, because you know how, when you're in a relationship with someone, you have expectations.
Right.
You have things you expect from them. And now all of a sudden, it's a case of, who do you think you are? Why are you doing this? And what's your point? And I'm sitting there trying to justify myself, and I'm thinking, no, you know me. And if you don't know why I'm doing this, then, you know, right now you're acting like a hater, and I'm not going to engage you in this, on this topic and in this space.
Right.
So again, this is someone who I talk to socially. We see each other, but when it comes to what I'm doing and, what's next for you, I keep it very close to my chest because I know that what I'm going to hear is likely to be negative and critical.
Wow. What a shame. All right, we're going to take a 3-minute break and we'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good, to live in harmony, it starts with you and me.
Oh, I love that song.
With you and me.
Anyway, welcome back. This is Deanna, and my guest today is Dr. Shola Chatty Ezi Okoli. Ezeokoli. And you mentioned your accent. Where are you from initially?
How long do you have?
Oh.
So I was when people ask me that question, I either say, depending on my mood, I either say I'm from Chicago or I say I'm a citizen of the world. So I'll give you the longer version. I was born in England. My father is from Nigeria. My mother is from Guyana, which is in South America. So I was born in England, but I grew up in Nigeria.
Wow.
And then when I went to medical school, then I lived in England for a while, you know, worked there, got my licensing, worked there for a bit. And then I came to the United States, where I have lived for the last 12 years. So I am a U.S. citizen. So where am I from? I don't know. Pick any one of four countries.
that is wonderful that you have that experience that's terrific. I used to have on my refrigerator I don't talk about my friends a great deal, but I used to have on my refrigerator just a little type note, and I just shared it in the chat room, and what it said was, is it kind? Is it necessary? Mm-hmm. Is it true?
Mm-hmm.
And if it didn't meet that criteria, then it wasn't worth talking about.
Yeah.
So it's probably idealistic, but,
yeah.
And I haven't always been, I haven't always abided by that. I say some mean-spirited things at times, but I attempt not to. I attempt to find the best in everybody. Sometimes that's a difficult thing, but
we're all human.
yes. But you said at the end of four, in handling haters, eight simple keys that work for all, and this is part two. You said, guess what? I did not listen to the negative critical people. And where would you be? Where would we all be if we listened to our critics and took their advice to heart?
Mm-hmm. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. Because you could be talked out of your dreams. You could be talked out of doing the right thing for yourself. I know somebody who ended up having, because of weight issues, had to have a surgery, and got down, lost maybe, I'm going to say half her size, but she was still had a ways to go. But what happened? Her friend started to say, what's wrong with you? Are you sick? You're getting so small. And guess what happened? She ate her way back. Somehow or the other managed to get another surgery. And then got back. The same thing happened to her twice. From listening to people who were like, oh, what's wrong with you? You're so small now. You're so, and when I say small, it was about maybe 200 pounds. So that's small, mm-hmm. but she was getting to where she was trying to be. And guess what? Negative, critical people. They can kill a person. They can kill your dreams. They can kill you. They can kill you. They can kill you because
physically,
just think of everyone. People trying to better themselves. They have people who come and say, what's wrong with you? You think you're better than us. They try to pull them down. And then guess what happens? Anything can happen from there. So it's so vital. It's so vital. Even if these negative, critical people are your friends, don't listen to that.
Right.
Don't
sometimes
listen to that.
Our biology is our biography.
Hmm.
And sometimes, because of who we've been, what we've experienced, really does function or distress our biology. It makes us ill. It makes us, it gives us physical symptoms, because of our thought processes.
That is correct.
Correct?
Yes, that is correct. Stress actually contributes to or causes up to 80%. In some studies, they up to 80% of illnesses are contributed to or caused by stress.
Right.
So yeah, it does play, your mental state plays a very huge role in your physical state. You know, we're not just
absolutely.
A mind separated from the body.
Right. Yes. In fact, sometimes your body is more your mind than your mind. For instance,
yeah.
I was listening to Dr. Joe Dispenza, and he said, you may not remember what your password is or telephone number, but you start typing and your body remembers it. So sometimes we depend more on our body and less on our mind. We develop our body over our mind. So that, and it contributes to materialism and the seeking of money and other things that really are pretty superficial.
Yeah.
In terms of being a whole person.
Yes, I completely agree.
And that's kind of what you're talking about here.
If yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
We, you know, there's one
of those commercials. But hey, they keep us on the air. We'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our doctor today, our guest, that we are so honored to have on is, Dr. E. We're just going to call her Dr. E, Dr. Shola E. And, I love in the article we're looking at, part two of haters, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are just so, the one thing you said something, in number 7, you cannot reason people out of a position that reason did not get them into.
Yep.
I just love this article. Love this article.
Thank you.
I'll post the URL in my chat room.
Okay. People, take positions that come from, a lot of times an emotional place and are not a, and a place of, I would say, use the word wrong perspective. So, you know, there's some things you can't reason a person out of. So why would you keep explaining yourself and explaining yourself and explaining yourself? And a lot of these things are things that I have tried and didn't work. So, you know, I'm speaking from experience. But hey, you know, you learn, right? You learn.
Right.
You learn very quickly that's not a right, that's not a the best use of your energy.
You are so right, because you shouldn't have to explain yourself. Somebody wrote in the chat room that she has a little flower magnet on her refrigerator, and it says, "Let your heart guide you." And you don't need to be around somebody that's going to beat you up no matter what you say or do.
Exactly. Because for some people, you'll just never be right. You'll never be right. You'll always be wrong. And it's just something about them and you that don't mesh together. But,
right.
You know, and it's okay. It's okay. You wish them, you know, peace and love and, hey, peace be unto you. But I'm not going to sit here and explain myself anymore. And let's just leave it where it is.
Right. And you say it's a waste of time. Explain it to negative, critical people.
Yeah, because they want to be negative and critical. So your explanation isn't going to do you or them any good.
Right.
So they'll all just find their chance to say, yeah, but. I remember this conversation that I had. It's like, oh my goodness, look, this is what I'm doing. And this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And you're almost, and somehow you get to a place where you're almost begging someone, well, please see my point of view. But it's like, no, you're wrong and that's it. And I don't want to hear anything you have to say. And when someone is giving you that kind of energy of, well, you're wrong and that's it. I don't want to hear you. You know that you're not operating from a place of logic. So how much logic are you going to apply to that situation? Not possible. Not possible.
Right. And the other thing too, if you buy into somebody that is giving you negative energy, negative comments, anger, you begin to doubt yourself, and then your self-talk becomes negative. And you, if you buy into it, you think, oh gosh, and self-talk, we have thousands of thoughts that go through our mind each day. Do we want them to be negative against ourselves?
Or do we want to
be joyful and loving?
Precisely. It's just, you know, we need more joy in the world, not less.
Right.
Not less. And on the other side of this is, if you meet someone and you don't understand what they're doing or whatever, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe you don't mean to be negative or critical, but you have this, you know, you don't understand. And it's like, well, you know, I don't think this is the way, you know, et cetera. And they won't listen. This is not time to, like you say, attack their character or anything like that. Just, you know, just say, okay, well, let's agree to disagree at this point and to give it some thought. You know, be kind. Because if you're kind to someone, then there's always that open door. And then they come back and be like, yeah, you know, I was wrong about that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Always make it about the issues and never about a person's character.
Always the issue. That in this conversation that actually I'm thinking about my you know, I was called names, my character was attacked.
Oh.
I literally went home, lay in my bed and started to cry. So About a bit later, a friend of mine called me and I was like, I'm supposed to be preparing for this presentation, but this person told me X, Y, and Z. She was like, get up off your bed now! You know, she was one of those like people who are like, no, she realized what was happening. You know, I was listening.
Right.
I was buying into the negative self-talk. She was like, get up your bed now! You know, and she said something about your people need you or something. And she, you know, she prayed. I mean, I don't know if you're religious or not, but I pray and I'm not shy about saying that I do. And that's not to say that I'm not trying to force my faith on anyone else. No, not at all, but just to say, well, this is part of my life. So she prayed and she was like, don't worry, everything's going to be all right. And she encouraged me. And I was like, thank goodness for this person at that time.
Don't you think it was just a coincidence, or don't you think that she was sent to you? At that time.
I call that God, okay? So.
Yes.
I call that God. Some people call it coincidence, and you know, it's fine if you call it coincidence, I call it God, because sometimes it just takes one conversation, one remark, one little thing, and a person is completely derailed and completely, you know, just, like you said, the self-talk becomes negative, they go into a spiral, and they sometimes never recover. We really have to be careful about what we let into our lives. And on the other side, we really have to be careful. Well, instead of just going out and just attacking people over things we don't understand.
Right. I am, not religious. I'm spiritual. I believe in a loving intelligence who sends us help when it's needed. And I believe that's what happened to you, that he, she, it. You broadcasted your sadness, and he brought you, he, she, it brought you help that you needed at that moment that maybe only that one person could give to you.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I completely believe it. Even to this day, sometimes I'm like, oh my goodness, if this person hadn't called me at that time.
Oh, yes.
How different things could have been, I could have gone. So I completely agree with you that the sense of help, love, and like you said, loving intelligence, you know, and the sense of help, yes.
Yes. let's see what, one of the things that you said in number 6, be love and light. Don't get bitter, get better.
Yep.
And I sense that you do not retain any bitterness towards the person that attacked you, but that, you are above that kind of feeling.
I like to say that I am. You know, sometimes when you say stuff like that, then something comes along and challenges your thoughts.
Right, but, that day. your guard was down. You were vulnerable, which mm-hmm. we are. Mm-hmm. We're all vulnerable. Sometimes we're strong. Sometimes we're vulnerable.
It's you know, don't get better, get bitter. One day I was I like to meditate and you know, I put on my
soul
music and just sit down. Oh, there you go. I meditate quite a lot, and you know, before I go for any big thing, and to me, it's just part of my practice now. And this thing just sort of, I would say, this word just came into my mind. It said transcend. You know, transcend. Like, you have to rise above. To be love and be light, you have to rise above. You have to learn to not take things personally. How I reasoned it out to myself, like, look, they don't understand. If they understood what I was doing, if they really understood, they wouldn't attack me. In fact, they would say, how can I help you? And how can I, you know, help you move forward? And I say, well, you know, they didn't understand. And if they don't understand, they don't. And that was how I got over it, you know, after my friend sort of prayed for me and, you know, gave me this little pep talk. So it's like, transcend. Don't learn to not be outraged over everything. You cannot, outrage just doesn't work in the long term. Don't be angry at people who don't know anything about you. Like, some people will get into it with people on Facebook that they don't even know. It's like, well, you don't know me, so, okay. One day I was trying to, I'm in this big group, this sort of dietary group again on Facebook, and somebody said, I said something about, again, you know, the doctor bashing that happens where doctors are held up as the bad boys and people ignore that they're insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies pulling the string.
Right.
And this person went on a doctor bashing spree. I said, well, you know, I'm a doctor and this is not the case. And, you know, pretty much what some of the talking points we shared here, I said, well, you know, this is what happens with pharmaceutical companies. This is what, you know, gave a few examples. And I wasn't, you know, I was very, you know, I would say calm in my writing. There was no abuse, nothing. The person said, I'm sure you're not even a real doctor from what you're saying. Show me your medical certificate. I just put one of those, you know, LOL emojis and I left the conversation. I didn't even, I was like, you know, I'm not going to get angry at someone who doesn't know anything about me. It's a waste of time.
Right. Absolutely.
It's a waste of time. Up level your thinking, you know, just learn to live happy. For yourself.
Right.
And forget about the haters or whatever.
I meditate morning and night. And sometimes I use most of the time I use a guided meditation.
Okay.
And depending on my state of mind, I never come out of a meditation the same as I went in. And some things strike me differently. The same comments strike me differently depending on the occurrences of the day, but mm-hmm. it's introspection is so important, and it develops your consciousness and your awareness of other people and yourself. And you said something in one of your other writings, always hold true. Life lessons that always hold true, part one.
Yep.
And you said, be more you. Be more of that person that you discover. Lean into your strengths and lean away from your weaknesses as you become more true to yourself. And that is so true, that when we really shut down everything that's outside of us and mm-hmm. really contemplate and discover ourselves, And it's so important to do that and not let other people tell you or claim to know who you are.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Because that doesn't really lead to any kind of helpful place. Because everyone sees things from their own perspective. So how do they know the you that you need to be for your world? How do they know what you need to be? You know, and I talked about being true to myself, and, you know, I used to be, for the longest time, I used to be, you know, I used to want to be soft-spoken. You're kind of like you, you know? It's so funny. When I heard your voice on the phone, I was like, man, she sounds so sweet and everything. And for the longest time, I used to want to try to, you know, I would say your kind of voice.
Mm-hmm. But yours is full of energy.
I don't have it.
And enthusiasm. It's okay. Because the softness comes through in what you say, not how you say it.
Okay, I'm going to write that down.
Yes, your spirit comes through. Your dignity comes through. And it sounds soft. It's joyous. You speak with joy.
Thank you very much. Yes, but I'm not quiet. I'm talkative. I laugh a lot. I'm one of those people who will make up my own jokes and laugh at them. My kids like roll their eyes like, Mom, that's not funny.
But the fact that you are joyful and you are expressing joy to your children, I'm sure that they have picked up some of those personality traits and some of your self-awareness, so you are setting a great example for them to follow.
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so.
Yes. You mentioned, you said, we feed our minds all the junk that comes on TV, social media, without discrimination. We neglect our spiritual state by not engaging in spiritual practices such as prayer, meditation, Bible reading, learning from spiritual teachers, fellowship, etc. Treat yourself with dignity. And how many people don't do that?
It's sad to say that people do not treat themselves with dignity because it's my belief that on some subconscious level, we don't feel we're worthy of it. So we will treat a celebrity, you know, with dignity, or, you know, some other person, or doctor, right? We treat our patients with care. You know, we go all out and everything. But when we are sick, we don't take the day off. I remember one day I came to work wearing a boot and a flip-flop because my ankle was swollen. My right ankle was swollen. I wrapped it in a ace wrap. I look ridiculous walking around with a boot and a flip-flop. Of course, then I came in and because, oh my goodness. The things we do to ourselves, like, if you had taken the day off to rest your ankle, the world would not have fallen apart. If you take time off from social media to just think about and, like you said, be introspective, the world won't fall apart. If you feed your mind real healthy stuff, you know, good books, good TV programs, the world is not going to fall apart. But we think that, you know, whether we're going to miss something, we don't treat our body well, we're going to run around and do this, that, the other. Yeah, we need to treat ourselves with dignity.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, we'll be right back. Are back, and our guest today has been Dr. Shola Shadi Ezeokolo, Ezeokoli, and her websites. I will post the websites in the chat room, but they are Shola Ezeokolo and Shola Shadi, It's been a remarkable conversation, I believe. There are some times when you spend time with a person and you come away feeling enlightened. You feel joy. You feel upbeat, and you know that your heart has been touched. And that's how I feel. That's how I feel talking
to you. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's really high praise. Thank you.
And you said in one of your articles, and I want to also talk about you going to work with a situation where you should have stayed home with your feet up and have people wait on you. It shows your nature that this is what you do. You trained to be a doctor, and you weren't going to let something that you probably thought, well, that I can do this.
I know. I can walk.
that shows your dedication, that you're gonna press on, and you're gonna do what people expect of you. And I'm certain that your patients that day really were very grateful that you.
They certainly were.
Yes, and probably you touched somebody's life that day, and had you stayed home, they would have missed something. Now, I don't want you to go to work sick a couple of times. So
yeah.
Don't do that.
Especially if you're sick with, don't go to work, especially if you're sick with something that you could pass to your patients. You don't want to do that. Definitely not.
Right. Right. But you never know who you may have touched that day had you not gone in.
That is true.
So, and one of the things that you said right at the end of this one article, Life Lessons, Part 1, remember this, you are in competition with no one. And I think that's really important.
You are in competition with no one. Only right. Person you're allowed to be in competition with is the person you were yesterday.
Ah, so, perfect. Perfect. that is terrific.
Oh, thank you.
The one thing that you have also said in part 2 is that gratitude is very powerful. And sometimes I think people want more than they need or I don't know, and maybe they're not grateful for it. But I think gratitude is something that says something about the person. And, I can't believe that our time is up. I am so grateful that I had you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Big, huge hugs to you.
Hugs to you too.
Okay, thank you so much.
I had the most fun ever.
Oh, me too. Me too. Thank you so much. I'm grateful
for
you.
Thank you. Thank you so very much for having me.
Thank you. Have a beautiful week.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Chat with you next week, and have a beautiful week, and be grateful, and thank you for listening.